Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Welcome back. I'm Father Matt Malone, Editor-in-Chief of America Magazine, and we are talking, as we do each week, about the news and the views at the intersection of the church and the world gathered by the team at America Magazine. And I'm joined by two of those team, Father Eric Sundrup and Robert David Sullivan. And we're talking with Dr. Sally Satel, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, about her piece in America, the issue of May 28th, Prescriptions Are Not to Blame for Today's Opioid Crisis. Hello, Doctor. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks so much for being with us. And I think we have your editor here with us, too, yes. Robert David Sullivan.
Yes.
Oh.
It's wonderful to have you on the broadcast. So for our listeners who may not have read the piece in America, what was the argument that you were making?
Yeah, I actually might, with all due respect to my editor, might tweak the title a tiny bit to say that painkillers are not currently driving
right.
the opioid epidemic. Yeah, and obviously the text reflects that. So, yes, obviously we have significant opioid crisis, and the overdose deaths are continuing to mount, even though prescribing of pills is actually starting to decline pretty impressively.
Mm-hmm.
What's driving the overdose deaths is actually heroin, and especially fentanyl, which is a synthetic opioid that is trafficked from China either through Mexico or actually by the mail, which is a huge problem with the dark web. And it's fentanyl is 50 times more potent than heroin. And so, as you can imagine, it's highly deadly. People who buy this on the street often don't know what they're getting. Some people who are trying to buy illicit pills on the street are actually buying fentanyl that's been pill-pressed into the shape of familiar pills, like Xanax, for example.
Wow.
And that's incredibly dangerous.
Oh, boy.
So this is what is really driving the problem now, which is not to say that some doctors still do not overprescribe. That was a big problem and continues to be an issue. But again, in terms of overdose crisis, and overdoses, as you know, are just part of this.
Right.
There are lots of social fallout beyond that, but they are no longer being driven by pills so much, but these other illicit substances.
So rather than, say, some doctor over-prescribing one of these drugs, the folks who are really, or the folks who are mainly abusing them currently are getting them illegally through some other means. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm saying that the substances that are predominantly responsible for the overdose deaths are, right, heroin or illicit fentanyl. And even among the painkiller deaths, they're rarely due to just one drug.
Mm-hmm.
On autopsy, the toxicology shows people mix drugs with alcohol. And that tends to be the fatal event is. But it's also very important to recognize that, and I think this is a myth that needs to be dispelled frequently because it's so persistent, which is the idea that the average person getting a few days of pills, and that's usually all people need if they need any opioid medication at all, and I'm referring to medications like Vicodin, Percocet, these kinds of things. People only need a few pills. True, doctors used to prescribe too much, and some still do. That's an issue. But they're not likely to get addicted to these. And I fear that that's one of the myths that's been circulating, is that these drugs are so dangerous that people should not even want to take them if they have, you know, real pain after a surgical procedure, something like that. The average person is not at risk for becoming addicted. Now, what's important to notice is that there are subgroups of patients who are at risk, and these are people who've had previous problems with pills or any kind or opioids, people who have had an alcohol problem, people who are suffering from pretty significant depression or anxiety. These are the kinds of situations that make people feel so grateful for the kind of psychic relief that you get from these medications that they are prone to keep taking them. But that's a subset. Most of the pills that are abused are actually not by patients. They're by folks who were given them the pills by friends or relatives, or they bought them on the street. And these are the pills that went into, these are the excess pills often that went into the medicine chest because doctors, without question, were giving a month at a time when all people needed was a few days, or maybe they even just needed some Tylenol and Motrin and a heating pad.
Right.
The old-fashioned way.
And how did we get here? How did this become a crisis?
Well, you could trace it in part to the fact that at least the dimension of this problem that was spurred by the overprescribing of drugs, because when those prescriptions started drying up, and that actually started in 2010 when OxyContin was reformulated, making it harder to chop up and smoke and inject, doctors were prescribing because starting around the late 90s and into the 2000s, in part because of pretty aggressive marketing by drug companies, but also there was from the standpoint of more of a cultural standpoint, there really was an undertreatment, a problem of undertreatment of pain in the 60s and 70s, and by the 80s, patient groups were starting to mobilize to get doctors to be more sensitive to chronic pain that wasn't cancer. And in even patients who had cancer in the 70s, some doctors were very reluctant to prescribe. It was this phenomenon called opiophobia, and it was spurred by a fear of addicting patients, which when you think about it makes almost no sense in the context of a terminal illness.
Right.
As in so many things, the pendulum, swung the other way, and doctors were being too promiscuous in prescribing these medications for, back pain or other chronic pain situations. So that definitely, had a big role in setting off this problem. But now, of course, there's an unintended consequence of all the efforts to cut back on prescribing, which is that there is a subset of chronic pain patients who have excruciating and intractable kinds of neurologic, inflammatory kinds of medical conditions, and they actually do well on high-dose opioids. They have been doing well for many years. This makes the difference between, at the very least, getting out of bed and feeding yourself, and at most, some people go to work. They have very productive lives. But doctors now are succumbing to this climate of paranoia that surrounds prescribing. And so chronic pain patients now, there's I'm glad now there's finally quite a bit of attention being paid to these people who were using their medications responsibly, but they've been swept up in this net to curtail prescribing, which I have to say does make sense as well, because doctors did prescribe too much, and as I said, a lot of that got diverted. But we have to be able to make distinctions. And there are people who have been given this for chronic pain. It's possible that when they first developed these conditions, they might have been treated somewhat differently with other kinds of interventions. But the point is that they weren't, and they did well with the medications. They're now on what's considered high dose, but as they say, they use it responsibly. They don't sell it. They're not addicted. They may be dependent, which is to say, if you stop the medication abruptly, they would have withdrawal symptoms. That's
right.
A completely normal physiological response. But these folks are now there's a panic among this population and a whole new term called pain refugees. That's to say people whose doctors stopped treating them, lowered their doses to the point where they can't function, and they are looking desperately for other physicians who will take care of them.
Right.
It's really a very sad state.
Dr. Sotelo, I think you mentioned it a little bit. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little on the distinction, because you used the term addicted versus dependent. And I think that's so crucial to understanding what's going on and some of the trouble that people with chronic pain are running into when, you know, they're taking opioids.
Sure. No, that is a very big issue. And I hesitate to tell you this, but I think some doctors sometimes don't quite appreciate that distinction. So dependence is physiological adaptation. And you take an opioid drug, the same with, frankly, a class of medication called benzodiazepines, even alcohol. You take a habit-forming drug for a sustained period of time, and if it is abruptly removed, you will go through withdrawal symptoms. That's to say, you'll have nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, achiness, and it can be very intense. Now, how long a person has to be on these medications to experience it is highly variable. Actually, after even a week, some people might have minor symptoms if they're very sensitive. Others, frankly, don't develop it for months. But the point is that is a normal physiological response. It would happen to, an animal in a laboratory situation. So doctors, and the only solution to that, which is quite easy, is to slowly taper the medication. And doctors should be aware of that. I know patients have sometimes, weathered the white-knuckled it themselves because the doctor either wasn't as aware as he should have been or just didn't communicate that to the person. So that's very important. But that's not the same thing as addiction. Now, to be sure, most people who are addicted will experience withdrawal if their medications, so they don't have access to their drugs. But addiction is a much more complicated behavioral state, and it's one of craving the drug, wanting the drug very badly, to the point where often responsibilities are ignored, or people make other kinds of compromises that hurt themselves, their health, their loved ones. And in my experience as a psychiatrist, it is almost always in the pursuit of some sort of mental relief. I've never met a contented, happy person who developed an addiction. I've certainly known contented, happy people who experiment with drugs, but that's a whole different issue. And when you think about it, there has to be some reason why people would make these sacrifices, as ambivalent as they are to make them and as much pain as it causes them. They know they're disappointing people, ruining relationships, but the relief is just so paramount that for a while in their life, that takes precedence.
So you said you're worried that many doctors don't know this distinction. How do we address that?
Well, I think I'm overly optimistic, but I do think that this problem of overprescribing and doctors often being played by patients, I hate to say it, sometimes for prescriptions, which a lot of times patients sell part of. I mean, it's really quite, if you've read Dreamland, it's really, which is by Sam Quinones, it's the biography of the opioid epidemic. There's a lot of abuse, as you can imagine, but there's been such an awakening in the medical profession to being much more cautious about using these drugs, understanding, you know, their side effects, what can develop, how they have to monitor patients more carefully, that I'm optimistic that the message is getting through, that they have to understand the phenomenon much better. I know they're giving all kinds of, there's lectures every week in medical centers, you know, about the issue. So and it also in training in medical school, because you can imagine so much of this is traced to what people learn during their training. I mean, when you finish your residency, most people go out into the, you know, practice in the community. There's only a minority of doctors who stay in a medical center where the learning is, you know, much more active. So if you don't learn something in residency, chances are you might not be as aware of it as you should when you're out there practicing. Right. But training is really being improved as well.
Dr. Sally Satel is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and we are talking to her about her piece in America Magazine, Today's Opioid Crisis. I'm Father Matt Malone. I'm joined by Father Eric Sundrup and Robert David Sullivan.
Yes, and you're talking about being optimistic about knowledge in the medical community, but the opioid crisis is now really a political, even a criminal justice issue, and I've been reading about states trying to regulate prescriptions, and we have these chains, drugstore chains like CVS, saying they won't even refill or fill prescriptions past a certain date. Do you worry about people outside the medical profession kind of intervening and not doing what's best for the patients here?
I mean, this is relates to what we were talking about before, about people who do need these medications not having access to them. You have to separate, I think, acute pain from chronic pain. And in the acute situation, it is true, some states, I think over half of states now have a law that an initial prescription for acute pain cannot exceed anywhere, depending upon the state, from 3 days to 10 days. I think 3 days is absurd. I know there was federal legislation proposing 3 days, and to me that is just an unconscionable intrusion into, you know, clinician discretion. I don't even particularly care for it at the state level. I think it's something medical societies should do. But the sort of the good news is, when it comes to acute prescribing, you know, 7 to 10 days is probably all someone needs. And most of these, I have to admit, I haven't seen a policy where a doctor cannot renew a prescription, but it should be made as easy for the doctor as possible. For example, the patient himself shouldn't have to show up to get that prescription if he's in misery. He should be able to send a family member, you know, that sort of thing. So because, again, acute pain typically resolves in a pretty short period of time, or people don't necessarily need opioids for it, that kind of restriction, although as I agree with you that I think it's quite an intrusion into care from other institutions, will probably not do much patient harm. It's the chronic pain patients who are really suffering the most.
Right. Now, Doctor, what do you think we need to do at the level of public policy to address this crisis?
Well, there's so many angles, but I have to, can I just thank you for not saying, A, who's to blame,
right,
and B, what's the answer?
Right.
Because clearly, you know, this is such a mosaic of forces,
sure,
that have both created it and that it will resolve it. It'll never stop it, because I'm Jewish, but at the risk of, can I say, you know, the poor you'll always have with you? I hope not, but
yeah.
The addicted you'll always have with you.
Sure.
And why not? Because it's a response to pain,
right,
and I mean psychic pain. But certainly we can do a lot better. And so there, if you think about it, in two categories, you know, supply reduction versus demand reduction. Supply reduction is very difficult. The supply, the aspect of supply that has to do with physicians, that we can deal with, and we are. We're making significant progress. You can look at a graph, and since 2011, prescriptions have really dropped off in an impressive way. I mean, they're at least 25% less than they were in 2011. They still probably have further to go. But in any case, we can handle that part. I see that as fairly doable. But the illicit supply of fentanyl is going to be a huge challenge, because it comes over the dark web. It comes, you know, through the postal service. The packages, you know, because fentanyl is so concentrated, you can just send a small package, and that will have a lot of deadly drug in it that then dealers will mix into fentanyl, the heroin supply. And it's very hard to find, and I know that the Postal Service and Congress are, this is a big issue. But the other problem with fentanyl, which is called, people call them now fentanyl analogs, because you just change a few molecules and you get a related but even more intense drug. And now we have something called carfentanyl, C-A-R F-E-N-T-A-N-I-L, it is 1,000 to 5,000 times more potent than heroin, if you can fathom. And
that is
not as prevalent as fentanyl, but that has, there have been outbreaks of that in some places. Carfentanil, I should say fentanyl is a fine medication. If you're post-surgical, they're going to probably give it to you in a pump. You use it. It's good, but it's given in micro doses.
Right.
And carfentanil has no known use in humans, but it is an accepted veterinary drug used for big game.
Wow.
When wardens have to tag them or transport big animals, and veterinarians and in zoos. But in any case, there are very creative chemists out there, and you don't have to be you don't have to have a Nobel Prize in chemistry to manipulate the molecule. So there'll be newer and newer versions of this, and that's really pretty scary. And then of course there's just basic interdiction from Mexico, and that's pretty hard too. But in any case, that's basically the supply reduction part of the picture. And then the demand reduction is largely treatment. You know, in the very acute setting, there's naloxone, Narcan, which is the antidote, the very fast-acting antidote to an overdose of opioids, which not only do police and EMTs have, but now you can go to the drugstore in, I think, most states and just buy it over the counter. And a lot of people who live in certain neighborhoods where they, I'm serious, they've, you know, McDonald's bathrooms have now become shooting galleries.
Yeah.
So McDonald's managers have it, librarians carry it. Anywhere there's a closed bathroom in a neighborhood where this is, rampant. It
right.
is a common place. So anyway, so that's the immediate, you know, that just keeps people alive.
Yeah.
But that's not enough.
Right,
and
right.
There's treatment. Obviously, our treatment infrastructure is very poor. I know Congress, I know everyone's really trying to work on this. There's so much work going on the ground. Basically, it's local response, but they need the money from the feds. And I'll just say one more thing, because you can imagine could talk about this forever, is that the criminal we've certainly softened as a culture our approach to this problem compared to, let's say, the crack epidemic. It's seen much more as a public health issue as opposed to a criminal justice one. But there is a role for the criminal justice system, and a very important one, because, you know, when people commit crimes, and I'm not talking about murder, but, you know, shoplifting, the kinds of crimes that are associated with supporting a drug habit, you know, people still have to be accountable, but their life doesn't have to be ruined because of it.
Right.
So when you hear this, was now a well-meaning but, to me, sort of an annoying mantra, which is we can't arrest our way out of it. I'd much rather people say we can't arrest our way out of it. Excuse
right.
me, we can't incarcerate our way out of it. Because by arresting people and having good diversion programs, which sends them to treatment, these now the leverage now of the judge is making sure they're going, and the promise of their charges being dropped when they complete it, which I think is essential to this working. You can take folks who, you know, were drop in and out of treatment or never even want to go to a treatment program, but now they're in it. And
right.
Well, some people might say you can't force it, but coerced treatment actually tends to work pretty well because people tend to internalize the values of the program, and
right.
and they see the virtue of recovery over time. Not always, but often.
Dr. Sally Satel is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. We've been talking about the opioid crisis in the United States here on America This Week. And doctor, you have about 30 seconds. If somebody is listening and is experiencing a problem with this or loves somebody who is, where can they turn?
They can, usually the Department of Health and their, where they live, have lists of treatment programs. The Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, S-A-M-H-S-A, has lists of treatment centers. Don't be afraid of taking, if your opioids are your problem, don't be afraid of taking the medications they might suggest, like methadone or buprenorphine. You don't have to be on them forever, but they really cut the craving, and you won't have any withdrawal symptoms if you go on that. Don't be fearful.
All right. Dr. Sally Satel, thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for your piece in America Magazine.
Oh, thank you so much.
And of course, you can find that piece, which the headline of which is "Prescriptions are not to blame for today's opioid crisis." Currently,
today's
opioid crisis, which you can find at americamagazine.org/serious, and you can actually find all of the content that we were talking about today. Pretty varied.
Yes, we covered a lot.
Right, from the political assassinations in the Philippines to polarization at Georgetown University to Star Wars to the opioid crisis. Well, I mean, it's indicative of the diversity of stuff that we're always talking about at America.
It seems standard to me, working in America.
Right. There's no shortage of things to talk about. That's what I always say, right? So as I said, to find all of these articles, you can go to americamagazine.org/serious. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter and on... Are we on Instagram?
Yes.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. And Instagram and probably something I haven't ever heard of. Right. But my nieces and nephews would know about it. Right. And to subscribe to America, you can call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. I would say that it is akin to getting a world-class Jesuit education for less than a dollar a week.
That's a really good marketing ploy. We might be using that.
I know, we might need to use that. For Father Eric Sundrup and Robert David Sullivan, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thanks for joining us. Good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.